Welcome. My name is Marina Pullen, and welcome to What Would You Do Differently? A podcast where business leaders with over 10 years of experience take a moment out of their very busy schedules to reflect on an event or an experience that shaped them in some way, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. But in the safety of this podcast, every guest gets to take a moment and think, what would I do differently? In doing this, we hope these true stories, and we have taken out details to protect and enable privacy. But we hope that through these stories, you can be inspired, and I already have been through the bravery and sometimes the recklessness. But it's also a chance for you to the next time an event or an experience hits you, your future self can guide you by asking you, what might you do differently? All right, without any further ado, let me introduce Peter Bacon. Hey, Pete, how are you? I love your shirt.
Thank you. That's much appreciated. I changed out of my t-shirt especially for this podcast.
It
It was
looks great.
my Friday afternoon working mode, so I've changed especially for you. But nice to see you
Well,
again.
not for me, because I've got cargo pants on. The internet can be quite judgy. But before we get into your story and hear your story, just as background, you're the CEO of DEA, not to be confused with the Drug Enforcement Agency here in Australia. But it's Disability Employment Services and Advocacy Group, in fact, the peak advocacy group in Australia. Do you want to just really quickly, because everyone's, I mean, it's something I'm passionate about, but tell me a bit about that before we get into your story.
So Disability Employment Australia is really in place because there's a lot more to be done in the world of getting as many people with disability to achieve their potential in work and life. So there's a lot of different strands to that. One of the things that we're doing more than anything else is we're advocating for better services for people with disability, but we're also taking a look at the sort of entire landscape and going, well, what needs to work better if we're actually to make a really tangible, transformative effect on the number of people with disability who are getting a chance to build their careers. So we're primarily a sort of members organization. So we represent the majority of providers, I think three quarters of providers who deliver disability employment services. So a lot of it's about the sort of two-way policy conversation we're having with our members and government. Beyond that, we're doing quite a lot to sort of work with academics to work out what the sort of ideal policy settings would be for Australia when it comes to this. And then we do beyond that, we do lots of things like hosting big events and conferences, as well as providing access to training and best practice resources for organisations and people involved in the sector.
For you, it's a, and I've been lucky enough to meet you face to face, and we've had chats, and the passion is palpable and positively infectious as well. So, all right, I'm excited for your story, and I was lucky enough to hear your story earlier in the week. So your story now, your story to me is all about love. It's like it's this weird transformation story about love and all different elements of it. Yeah, so without, I'm not going to take any more time. I'm going to hand it to you to tell everyone your story.
I suppose when you told me about this podcast, I thought, well, what are the things that I really have messed up in my career? And there's definitely a lot of times where I've messed things up, but I think the things that really scare you are the things where you're not just messing up at work, but you're in danger of messing up your life as a whole. Like, you can always go and get another job. Well, most of the time you can, but it's hard if you ruin your life by the way that you're dealing with things. And when I think back to that, it was really actually in that sort of first year after I had my first child, and that was about 10 years ago. And I was living in London at the time. And so it was very much a kind of, the work-life balance was different to what you get in Australia. It was very kind of work-firsty kind of culture.
Yeah. How old were you?
So I would have been, I was about 29, maybe 28, 29. So I wasn't that old. It was before most of my friends had kids. So I didn't necessarily have that strong a support network around me of mates who said, well, that you need to do it this way. And so during that time, I think I did mess up quite a lot, because I think, like a lot of new dads, I didn't know quite what to do at home. That's not to say I was incompetent with the baby. I was changing nappies, all that kind of stuff, but I didn't quite know my place in it, and I was struggling. And so what I did as compensation, and to sort of, I suppose, make myself feel valuable, was I really threw myself hard at work, which was something that was quite doable. I was heading up tender teams at the time within a very large multinational organization. So it sort of relates to the space that I'm currently in. And so there's plenty of opportunity if you want to work 80, 100 hours a week, to work 80, 100 hours a week in that kind of role. But I wasn't doing it necessarily because the role demanded it. But I was doing it because it was, frankly, maybe an escape from being at home and having a child who just wouldn't sleep. She was not a sleepy child.
Yeah.
It's funny, now she sleeps until like 10:30 in the morning if she can. But and you know, she hasn't subsequently been a difficult child either, but not a sleepy child. So a bit of an escape from that, and the fact that, you know, maybe my wife was struggling too, and also, you know, it was a way of saying, well, I'm doing something to make our lives better here, which is I'm trying to work really, really hard so I can win bids and get promotions, so we can move out the tiny rented flat that we've got and buy a house and all those kind of things. So I think that really affected my attitude to that. And it was my sort of self-justification for the way I was behaving. But then, of course, I was getting very stressed about it. You know, you work too hard, you go home, you don't sleep. You're not yourself at all. So it becomes that sort of self-reinforcing cycle. And then your marriage maybe isn't the best place because you're arguing. And then you think, well, I'm going to go and work more because, yeah, you know, there's all said reasons, really.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
I did that in my 20s too. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there is something to be said for, I think, when you're young, throwing yourself into your work in a kind of positive way of going, well, yeah, I'm going to put my hand up for things and I'm going to take responsibility for things and I'm going to push myself. But you've got to sort of check where that impulse is coming from. And you've also got to assess whether you're actually doing the right thing for the right reasons, I think.
Yeah. Do you think you had the grounding or the self-awareness of even just like who you were back in your late 20s or early 30s that to even know when you had drifted away from who your core is?
I think I'm very good at self-justification, as many of us are. Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I think you, like in anything, you sort of start with a set of assumptions and you end up with your logical conclusion. But if your assumptions are faulty, then you end up with some faulty conclusions. And then you keep telling that to yourself until the point where you can't tell that to yourself anymore. And you have to then examine the assumptions. So did I know myself well enough? No, probably not. Like, as I say, you know, I was not young as a dad by societal perspectives, but I was young compared to my mates. And I was probably immature. Like, also things like, you know, my mates were going out every weekend still at that stage. They aren't anymore, but they were at that point. So I feel like I was missing out. And I was probably too immature to go, well, I'm not really missing out, because I've got this beautiful child and wife at home. That's not missing out. It's just a different thing. But at this point, I would have that attitude. But at that point, I felt, you know, it's the sort of FOMO and the maturity issue. And so, as I say, you know, I created a set of assumptions around my life that sort of helped me self-justify. The set of assumptions are like, we need more money. Because, you know, we kind of did. Like, we're living in a flat in London. We were renting it. It wasn't the best flat in the world even. Let alone being able to afford a house within reach of work. I'm not for money, and that seemed like a pipe dream to me. So that was one assumption, is we need more money. The second is, if I work hard, I will at some point earn more money. Again, that's not a completely stupid assumption either.
No.
So then the third one was kind of, you know, frankly, it wasn't meant to be gendered, but it's probably rooted in some of those gendered norms of, well, she can, you know, she doesn't have to work at the moment, so she can look after the baby And I'm going to go out and I'm going to do the things that I can to set our family up in the best way possible going forward. So some of that isn't, strictly speaking, selfish.
No.
Albeit there was a selfish element in it, but it's a set of assumptions that led me to a behavior which was selfish in nature. And I think that's interesting in itself. So I think I didn't know myself well enough, or I didn't like necessarily have my priorities set well enough, that my starting set of assumptions was quite right. And, you know, I compare that to when we had a second child, when I was already kind of suburban dad, owned a house, that kind of thing. So 5 years later, and I had a different set of assumptions around what I needed to be for my family, and I did it all better. So I think it's actually an interesting point is, well, what are the sort of governing set of assumptions that you put around your life? Because that's how the logic flows from there. It's like a financial model or a design piece or anything like that. It's just the same thing.
Yeah. It's a hard one, isn't it? Because when you think about your 20s, you actually are a different person.
Yeah.
And so you're a reflection of your experiences and your knowledge. So even that context is, it's not faulty at all. It's just different. And your capacity to deal with some of those life experiences is really different as well.
Well, if I think about it now, so I'm you know, nearly 40 now. And if you go, well, that was the midpoint between that and me being a child from this vantage. And probably I was at that midpoint, or maybe slightly closer to being a child than I am now. You know,
that's a good way to put it.
10 years before that, I could barely talk to girls. And then 10 years after that,
like, actually, yeah, what are you thinking of it?
You know. So there absolutely is a maturity element, but you know, this is also a piece of, I think it's interesting in that I look at my behavior during that period where I was being snippy, I was working too much, I wasn't leaning in at home anything like the way I do now, and I go, actually that was unacceptable, I wasn't giving my wife the right support, all those kind of things. In an earlier generation, would I ever have examined that set of assumptions? Because it was the done thing. And that's maybe an interesting question is, you know, we sort of exist at an interesting point in generationally what men should be and all that kind of thing. You know, you mentioned that you got kids who are looking at podcasts which maybe point them in the wrong direction. And but it is hard. Yes. And it is something you have to work through. What, as a man, is your role in this? What should you be? And at that point, I think there were selfish and unselfish reasons, and it pointed me to a version of being the man, which was, you go out, you earn the money, you shouldn't be expected to do that much at home. So it's interesting in the context, I think, of where we're at.
I think when we were talking, like, your intentions were sound. That, you know, that saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I'm not saying that it was hell, but this idea that you're driven through intention, whether it's through career achievement, being a breadwinner, and filling a role that maybe you've had in your head of what a traditional man in that circumstance should behave like. But then the actions sort of rolled out a bit. I don't want to say the word destructive, but they probably didn't really enhance much of that time of your life. But no, they have enhanced where you are now, which is where it all gets very confusing. Like,
they might have. I would argue perhaps they didn't actually, because, sorry, I just...
That's right, you take a water because we're about to get to the point where I have to say, what would you do differently?
I've just got a little bit of cold.
We both.
I'll start again. Let's just get it out. It's hard because you hold it back and then it all comes out.
I know, it gets worse. It's like most things.
Yeah, true enough, isn't it? That's an apt metaphor. I think the thing about that point around my self-justification is that if you look through history, most people who do bad things in life don't do it because they think they're doing a bad thing. I gotta say.
I'm not laughing at you. That's terrible.
It's awful. Yeah. I did this yesterday at one point too. It just hits you. It's not COVID. Oh man, it's not COVID. My eyes. The people see the edit and they see my eyes are watering afterwards. I think I'm emotional. I'm so emotional. I'm not. I'm fine. I just got a cold. Anyway, edit that, please.
I got really emotional when we talked about it. I'm like, oh, it's a nicer story.
All right, I'll go again. So I think, yes, that's right. My self-justification didn't necessarily come from a bad place, or exclusively a bad place. But history is, you know, I like history, and history is littered with people who built a kind of model of self-justification that allowed them to commit the most heinous acts. You know, you look at people who sort of did bloody revolutions and that kind of thing. I mean, they didn't necessarily think they were doing a bad thing, but nevertheless they did it because they set up a kind of moral universe in which they were doing the right thing, regardless of how perverse it seems, or just fundamentally wrong or evil it seems to us now. So yes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But it plays out in minor ways too in people's lives. You know, how do people go off and have affairs? Well, it's because they say to themselves, well, I'm not doing something wrong because, you know, my significant other kind of, you know, has forced me to do this in some way. Yeah. It's fundamentally a wrong thing to do, but people justify things to themselves by creating a moral universe in which they're still the hero. And now I look back at that period and I look at my moral universe and I go, well, I wasn't the hero of that piece. I wasn't necessarily an arch villain either, but I could have, if I'd had my head screwed on, behaved in a way that was more appropriate. I could have supported my wife more. My wife, who is, you know, Australian, and she was living in England, didn't have anyone around her apart from me. You know, I could have.
So what would you have done differently? I think it's such a love story. I like these stories.
Well, you know, I suppose the long story short is we are still together. So I did manage to break out.
Yeah, don't break my heart.
No, we're doing really well. It's still very much in love, and we've now got two kids and all those kind of things. So I did break out of it at some point. And it's easy to say, oh, I had an epiphany. You know, I was on the road to Damascus and something, there's some Deus Ex Machina came along and changed my mind. No, that wasn't really it. I think it was probably just maturing into it a little bit, which helped. Small babies are hard. I've had, you know, lots of mates who become parents since, and I've given them, you know, this kind of advice is small babies are hard. Don't expect, you know, you will fall in love with the baby pretty quickly, but don't expect that you're immediately going to love everything the baby does, because you're not. The baby's going to wake you up. The baby's not going to give you anything in return, apart from maybe some vomit on your shoulder. They can't do anything for ages. Small baby is not my favorite phase of parenting. I will be candid about that. Because then you get to the other bits, when suddenly they can do stuff. They can walk. They can talk. They can show you that they love you, and you start getting that back, and then it becomes that kind of, you know, that sort of, it's never sort of full reciprocity with your kids, of course, but it's but there is, you know, it's a bit easier. And you know, I've got a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old now, and it's still challenging. But if I say, you know, please go and get dressed, they can do that. They can do that. Whether they will do that is an entirely separate matter, but they can do that. And then,
so
I think you mature into it. So I think probably took till she was about one. I talked about that first year as being hard. So there was no real kind of road to Damascus moment where it changed. I think I matured into it a little bit. And I probably had the odd comment, like someone super senior at work said something like, oh, I remember that first year. Yeah. Of your kid's life, I remember I did what you're doing. I just went and worked too hard. And that sort of, on one hand, was like, okay, that's, you know, that's a bit of, I'm being called out by somebody senior. On the other hand, like, he's a super senior person in a multinational company. I mean, that's that's what he did, right? So it cuts both ways. But the, you know, I give you know, I've given the advice to my friends thereafter, which is around, firstly, however hard you're finding it, your wife or partner's probably finding it harder. Because you may go, oh, well, you just have to be at home all day, but she has to be at home all day. That's, you know, she doesn't necessarily, certainly in the case of my wife, she didn't necessarily have any escape from that. Especially when she was away from her support network. And then there are things that physically, you know, men can't do. And again, that would depend on the choices that you make as parents as to how you do that. But in our case, my children are breastfed. So the feeding thing, I was really a bystander. So, you know, again, you need to be supportive. And the other great advice, is the advice I give is that thing that's on the tip of your tongue, like, even, you know, if she's had a pop at you, the thing that you want to say back, that witty retort or that smart remark, don't say it. Yeah. leave it in your head. Just don't say it, because no good comes of it. And I do have a sharper tongue than I'd like to have sometimes. I try not to use it. And that bit, yeah, I was knackered, full of self-justification, and I'd say stuff, and it's like, you know, I look back at it now and I cringe, because I was, you know, well, I probably can't say that word in the podcast, but it was, you know, it's
probably, we can do it if we like.
I was being a word beginning with D, and maybe ending with head. Like, that's what I was being.
A doofus head.
That's right. I was being a doofus head. A dunder head is what I was being. But there wasn't really a moment. It was maturing. It was my child coming out of it. And then I suppose what would I have done differently is all of those things. Like, I think I would have... Well, I kind of did do it differently. I suppose it's an easy what we do differently, because it's what I did with my second child, is I relished the fact that for a period I was going to have to rework my work-life balance and lean in harder at home. I had an obvious role in it, which was, you know, while the small child's being looked after, we had another smallest child, we had a five-year-old child, and then very much I have a role there, you know, in terms of making sure she's okay, and adapting well to the fact that she doesn't have 100% attention placed on her anymore, you know. And, you know, I speak to work around, well, you know, how are we going to make this work-life balance work? You know, let's have a grown-up conversation about it. I'm still going to do plenty of work, I'll still be productive, but how am I going to make that work? I check in my wife regularly with her mental health to make sure she was doing okay. I'd lean in more to making sure that the house didn't look an absolute pigsty, which is a hard thing in the first year of a child's life, I think. It's a relatively hard thing, even when they're 5 and 10, I can tell you. But all those things that I could have done better the first time, I think I did do it better second time around. But that's because I was in a place of emotional maturity. I was already there, right? So I was already a dad. I'd been a husband for, you know, for half a decade or more. I had a house. It wasn't an amazing house at that point in my life. It was our first house that we bought, but it was a house. And so and it was in, you know, suburban Australia at that point. So, you know, my wife was a bit closer to a support network. And I, you know, we're living in the suburbs, right? So I was already there. I was already suburban dad. I didn't have FOMO about going out with my mates or those kind of things. So I suppose the thing that I would do differently is I'd just kind of do what I did second time around the first time around. Maybe it was a formative experience in me becoming the kind of, you know, man, leader, husband, dad that I am today. Maybe I needed to go through it. Maybe I didn't, I don't know, but that's hard to really completely fathom and conceptualize, is, you know, if I'd just been slightly more grown up in that first of time, and I'd applied a slightly different set of, you know, assumptions and a different moral universe, did I need to be a dunderhead for a year? I probably didn't. I'd not generally been a dunderhead over my life. I don't think I've generally been sort of, I would say, pretty kind to those around me. But yeah, those are the kind of things I think I would have done differently. And I do try and pass on that sort of experience to people who are just becoming dads now. Someone I know who's going to be a dad in a few months, and I said exactly all those things. And if I catch him doing the wrong thing, I'll call him out on it. I think he'll be fine. But there's other mates who I have too. At the time where I've been a bit like, I see what's happening here. You're leaning on really hard at work. There's a time and there's a place for that. When you have a 4-week-old infant at home, it's not the time. It's not the place. This is a very specific moment in your life where you need to have your priorities screwed on.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I love this story of love. And I like hearing men talk about this stuff from their side, because there's a lot of stuff about experienced women. But the part I take out of our conversations is it's a complex one, because when you're going through life, you actually don't have yet, you haven't read the book yet, you haven't got to the chapter yet that tells you that this is a high risk behavior. So many of us just start doing things like in our late 20s, 30s, whenever it is, where these worlds of family and career and everything just crush at once. Yeah. And the challenge we've all got is that we all think we're sane. We all think we're handling stuff really, really well. And, like the boiling frog type of analogy. But I think there is something powerful when you're back, when you get that bit older, whether it's in leadership, personal, sports, whatever it is, where you stop and you reflect and go, I wasn't being my best self then. And you don't do it to flog yourself, but you do it as a way to act as a boundary. That's my edge. I'm not doing that again. And I think that's a really strong message for everyone to reflect upon. Like, who are you? And where do you stop being yourself?
Yeah. I think it's exactly that. Or what does the worst version of myself look like? And that kind of was underslept, being unkind to people I loved, not doing my bit at home. That's what to be honest with you, I was working. I'm not sure the quality of my work was all that at that point.
It probably wasn't.
And you said something before about, did it get you ahead in your career? I don't think it did, because actually I sort of, I fell out with somebody at work, probably because I was tired and stressed, who was not a good idea to fall out with. It was brief, and he kind of forgave me and that kind of thing, but it was a permanent black mark, which I think stopped me from getting a promotion I might otherwise have gotten later down the track. So I think that's probably another interesting reflection, is that actually, yes, you can be that person, you can be the person who works a million hours and is a bit stressed about it and all those kind of things. But if you're playing that high wire act and you get it wrong, it's actually not a good career advancer. There's no way that I would get it wrong in the same way these days. It's kind of polite to a fault.
Just more confidence. You've read that chapter of the book now, and you're like, I know what's going to happen. So
but it's interesting. The other thing you say about there being no manual, and that's right, isn't it? I remember speaking to my dad about parenthood and all that kind of thing once. Because of course, as you grow up, and I'm sure it's true of my children now, they sort of think, our parents are these omnipotent people who know exactly what they're doing, and they know how to be parents and know how to live their lives. And the truth is, and I spoke to my dad about it, and I was probably 17 or 18 or something, and he said, Pete, I just think I'm basking it. I've been basking it the whole way, to be honest with you. I'm completely freewheeling.
Basking it.
Like when you're a teenager, you're like, oh, really? I thought you knew what you were doing. Like, no, did not know what I was doing, still don't. And that's also as you get slightly older, facing down the barrel of 40, sort of, when I was 20 years ago, I thought, oh, gosh, that's old. You probably have everything sorted out in your head by now. And someone looking at me now might think, oh, he has everything sorted out in his head by now. I don't. I'm still basking it. I can still get stuff wrong on the reg. And
but I think the difference, as you get older, like professionally and personally, is that you've got this sort of toolkit of experiences, and you can see patterns differently, and you go, okay, I'm going to do this, or I'm not going to do that, and which you don't have. You've got to actually play the game a bit, and you've got to build up those credits, which you just don't. You can't YouTube that. You actually do need to, and you have to put it within your own context, you know, and put it inside you and go, okay, that's my toolkit now. So,
all right. I think that's right. Yeah.
I think so. We're over time.
Okay.
It's an abrupt ending. Thank you so much, Peter, for sharing your insights and the story of love. Like, you know, and how the love changed for your career. And I always love hearing a man glow about his wife and his kids. So, that's going to make my day for the rest of the day. And unfortunately, this won't air before Valentine's Day, but you can just let her know that there's a whole lot of people going, oh, he's so lovely.
She might listen or watch the podcast and think it's something by way of a belated apology for how I was at that point. So
let's hope so. Yeah. It's pretty good. It's pretty heartfelt. So,
yeah.
I'll send you a copy so you can send it to her. All right. Nice. You have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And it's a nice one. What would you do better? So thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
No problem.
Click. I hate